From Heterodox Academy, this is Half Hour of Heterodoxy. Conversations with scholars and authors, ideas from diverse viewpoints and perspectives. Here's your host, Chris Martin.
Charlie Sykes is my guest today. He's a conservative political commentator who hosted a popular talk radio show from 1993 to 2016. He later joined the Weekly Standard magazine and hosted the Daily Standard podcast. In December 2018, after the shuttering of the Weekly Standard, he and William Crystal founded the Bulwark website, hiring many former staff members of the Standard. And Charlie currently hosts the Daily Bulwark podcast. It comes out every weekday, and it features interviews with politicians, professors, and commentators. He's also the author of several books, including Fail You from 2016 and Prof Scam from 1998 about higher education. And his most recent book is How the Right Lost Its Mind. Hi, Charlie. Welcome to the show.
Hey, it's good to be here.
Thank you for joining us. I do want to talk about your latest book. But before we start, because this is an academic podcast, I have an academic question. If you were to visit an undergraduate classroom today and give the students an introduction to the trajectory of conservative media in the United States, what would you say to them?
Well, that's a broad question. I would start by saying, please don't blame me for everything that's happened, even though I'm somewhat responsible for it. I was part of it, but I didn't see it coming. I want to start with one thing, sort of before the fall of conservative media. You know, I'm going to put a quotation mark around that. I'm fascinated by the fact that there was really no significant conservative media infrastructure during the Reagan years. That Ronald Reagan, in the highlight of the conservative revolution, there was no talk radio, there was no Breitbart, there was no internet, there was no Fox News. And yet people look back on that as, hey, conservatives did pretty well. They were able to be successful. So I think that that's important to kind of keep in mind for people who think that the conservative movement is a complete creature of talk radio and of the rest of the conservative media. But I would also say that, you know, I go back to when I started in conservative talk radio. I had been in print. I had been in a newspaper reporter, a magazine editor, and found the idea of talk radio to be somewhat fascinating, but also puzzling. What was it about? And I started doing this on a regular basis about 4 years after Rush Limbaugh went on the air in the late 1980s. And one of the things that really struck me was that there was a real appetite for an alternative point of view. And back then, that's what I thought it was. I thought we could be the other side of the story. We could balance out things that the rest of the media was either not interested in or was reporting from a jaundiced point of view. And there was clearly a massive audience for this. It was a little bit like pouring water on parched earth when people began to, you know, tune on AM radio, which, by the way, AM radio was like an abandoned strip mall. I mean, nothing was on AM radio anymore. There was no great conspiracy to put conservative talk shows on AM. AM was dead. But there was clearly, you know, an appetite for it. And people said, wow, you know, it's to have a media outlet that doesn't look down on me, that doesn't disdain me, that is actually concerned about the kind of things that I'm concerned about. And it was, I think, healthy in those early days. And, with folks like Limbaugh, I think, had a certain sense of humor. There was a certain sense of parody. And but that did evolve over time, which is what you're asking about. And really, the larger point would be that it evolved, I think, from being one voice among many, an alternative voice, to becoming an echo chamber, to morphing into an alternative reality silo that we have today. And one of the things that I wrestle with is, you know, how did this happen? How did it go from being, you know, I always thought of talk radio, conservative talk radio, as sort of being like an op-ed page, so that, you know, I would be writing columns from a center-right conservative point of view. But suddenly it became, it took on a life of its own.
And I'd like to talk about your book, which is largely about conservative media. But before we jump to that, going to your 2016 book, Fail You, The False Promise of Higher Education, what critique of higher education were you trying to level in that book, and what was the genesis of that book?
Well, that genesis of that book was a follow-up to my very first book, which was Prof Scam, which was published in, I think, 1987. I don't want to do a Joe Biden and get the decades wrong here, which basically was a critique of the abandonment of undergraduate education. I mean, the heart of that book was that higher education, particularly the big research universities, had, you know, shifted their focus away from teaching undergraduates, which also then led to the degradation of the liberal arts as central to higher education. And it also began to talk about, and going back into the 80s, talk about what became known as political correctness, the push for ideological conformity on campuses and the intolerance for certain ideas. So I wrote that back in 1987 and decided to revisit it and ask the question, well, what's happened since then? And tracing all of the things that I had critiqued in the late 1980s and concluded that many of them had become worse, that the flight from teaching had gotten was more extensive. You also had the overlay of the explosion of student debt, the cost of higher education, questions about whether or not too many students were spending too much time, too much money on things that were not perhaps wise life choices, and then of course revisiting what was happening with the intellectual climate on campus.
Okay, so now your latest book, How the Right Lost Its Mind, it's been about a year since it came out. Received a lot of publicity when it came out because, as you said at the beginning of this interview, you expressed some remorse over perhaps being part of this alternative reality bubble. I thought it was a great book. I liked the reflections on the changes in conservative media that you document and the insider take that you have. But you do suggest that what happened in the 2010s was a departure from what had happened before that. And I do see a contrast between the 2010s and, let's say, the early years of National Review, which is one of the points you make. But some of the developments don't seem entirely new. For example, if you look at Sarah Palin from 10 years ago, she was pretty similar to Donald Trump. And then going back much further, Newt Gingrich had tactics that were quite similar to Donald Trump's in some ways. And I'm thinking of an interview he did with McKay Coppins in The Atlantic. He's been strongly approving of Donald Trump's performance and presidency. And as we know, his wife was appointed by Trump as the ambassador to Vatican City. So I do see these threads going back about 40 years at least. Do you see something different about the 1980s compared to the present?
Well, you know, I did a follow-up for the paperback edition. And one of the things I said that I regretted was that I didn't focus more on the impact of Newt Gingrich in creating this new climate. And there's no question about it. You know, Sarah Palin, you could argue, was sort of patient zero in this populist uprising. But there's no question about it. And this is something that I'm still trying to parse through. You know, what was the recessive gene and what was the dominant gene? What did we ignore? How long does this go back? I mean, clearly, you can trace this all the way back to, you know, the new right back in the 1970s that was, you know, dallying with the idea of George Wallace because he would fight. You can take it back into the 1930s, you know, the Father Coughlin, you know, just type of demagoguery. But no, you make a right, you make a good point there. There was clearly a shift in the mid-1990s, in which politics became warfare. And this did track with the rise and the evolution of the conservative media. You know, it's not a coincidence that when the Republicans took control of Congress in 1994, the freshman class invited, of all people, Rush Limbaugh to speak to them, because this was the beginning of this sort of synergy between the new conservative media and Congress. Now, could people have predicted that the conservative media would morph into the alternative reality that it did at that point? No, because we weren't that big. Could we have predicted that Republicans would lose the ability to govern, or actually the interest in governing, because of this transformation? And I don't know. I spent some time with Newt Gingrich early on in his speakership, and I have to say that I was somewhat underwhelmed by his intellectual discipline and I'm trying to parse my words here, which nobody does these days, but his shall we say, his lack of a principled consistency. And so in some ways, in retrospect, it becomes sort of clear how that might lead to Trumpism. But let's be honest, nobody actually saw that happen, that coming.
And when it comes to Fox News in particular, we know that's had a really large role on the conservative media landscape. And I should cite my sources. So this question actually comes from my wife. It was her reaction to reading your book. What do you see as the future of Fox News?
Well, that's a really good that is a good question. And it's particularly a good question this week because the president is lashing out at Fox News. I mean, he thinks that Fox News is a house organ of Trumpism. I mean, he demands absolute loyalty. And he's obviously very bothered by the fact that Fox, you know, is not 24/7 pro-Trump propaganda, you know, and Fox. You know, there's no question about it. You cannot tell the story without Fox. Fox isn't alone. But one of the things that if you would have asked me this question maybe 6 months ago, I would have said is that Fox was, at least for a time, obsessed with being outflanked on the right, that they're looking over their shoulder at groups like it was One America Now Network and concerned that, well, you know, if we're not sufficiently pro-Trump, somebody else is going to seize that mantle. They're going to seize that space. I'm not sure that that's the case right now. And in part, it has to do with the succession. Who knows what's going on with the Murdochs? There does seem to be, you know, some cover for folks like Shepard Smith, who have been actually, you know, legitimate journalists, Chris Wallace. But on the other hand, look at their primetime lineup, and the primetime lineup has become more and more virulent. You know, the Tucker Carlsons, the Laura Ingrams. So. The answer to your question is part of like, well, what is the future of the conservative movement? What's the future of the Republican Party post Trump? Are they still is this sort of strain still going to have a market? Is this where they're going? I honestly don't know.
And one of the things Fox News has done, among others, is allow Republican politicians to publicize these promises, these unrealistic promises that they make. And your book references E.J. Dionne's critique of the conservative movement in America and how one of the central problems is that Republican politicians have promised a set of incoherent goals that can't really be reached. But that sort of has snowballed. So do you realistically see some or any kind of Republican leader pulling away from that and transforming the party?
It seems naive to think that will happen. It really does, and that critique is really, you know, central to the, you know, recent years. Is the, you know, you make promises that literally cannot be fulfilled, and yet you demand that leaders pursue it, even though there's no chance. And then when reality intervenes, you accuse them of caving in or being weak or betraying the base. And that whole outrage machine has become the model now of the conservative media. And because it's become the model of the conservative media, it's become the model of Republican governance and lack of governance. So, no, I don't see that. I was actually on a TV show yesterday, and we're talking about Joe Biden suggesting that if he gets elected, he'll be able to work with the quote-unquote good Republicans, and which I appreciate that he's open to bipartisan cooperation, but it feels extremely naive to think that that's going to be happening anytime in the near future.
Right. One of the points I make to my students when I talk about politics in the U.S., and I try to differentiate the Republican Party from conservative parties in many other countries, because in many countries, conservative parties are open to compromising with centrist and liberal parties, and they form coalitions with them sometimes. In the U.S., one of the tenets of the conservative party, the Republican Party, is we don't compromise, so it's really difficult to say in the United States specifically what we really need is for the Republican Party and Democratic Party to get together and reach some compromises.
Well, and also, but that is a relatively recent phenomenon, because in terms of conservatives, it depends how you define conservatism. If you define it in sort of a Burkean pragmatic sense, of course you're going to compromise. You're going to try to come up with solutions to real problems. I mean, we think of Ronald Reagan as a hardcore conservative ideologue, but he had to govern when Democrats controlled both houses of Congress. Most of his major achievements had to be on a bipartisan basis. Even the Bushes worked with Democrats on a variety of issues to get legislation passed. So this notion that you must have not only purity, but you can never work with the other side, I think Gingrich probably fired that up. But that really is something that would be a relatively recent phenomenon.
Now, you talk about some of this being due to an alternative reality bubble, and the term bubble crops up a lot nowadays. People say conservatives are in a media bubble, liberals are in a media bubble. What proportion of conservatives and what proportion of liberals would you say are in a conservative and liberal media bubble, respectively?
Yeah, I try to avoid the word bubble because it got overused. So I use silo because it is sometimes hermetically sealed. So when I talk about an alternative reality silo, I mean someone who, you know, it really is immune to outside information. And the story, I'll get to your question. I mean, why I say that. And I'm talking about people who, I did a radio show for 23 years, and for much of that time, I think I had a very good rapport with the audience. And when they would send me things that were false or that were hoaxes, I would push back and I would say, look, this is not true. If you don't like Hillary Clinton, that's fine. But no, there's not, you know, bodies stacked up in a warehouse in Little Rock, etc. And no, Barack Obama, you know, is not really a secret Muslim from Kenya. You know, disagree with him on policy. And for most of that time, people would say, hey, thank you, appreciate it. You know, I'm sorry I forwarded, you know, Uncle Leo's, mass email, etc. I'm sorry I passed that on to my Facebook friends. But in 2015 and 2016, I began noticing that it became harder and harder, that nothing I could send people was considered credible. If you'd send somebody something from the New York Times, the Washington Post, or from NBC, the reaction would be, well, those are liberal rags. And that was when I had to go, okay, so our media critique has been so successful that we have successfully delegitimized all of this fact-based media. There are no referees anymore. There are no guardrails. So when I'm talking about the alternative reality silos, I'm talking about people who really are immune to any sort of outside information. So that's probably a relatively small but very active group. But see, this is the part of the problem. You look at at the polls, and it would certainly suggest that a strong majority of conservatives now are in this echo chamber. They are in this alternative reality silo. And this is reflected in public opinion polls about Trump, but also about different issues. They live in worlds with the different narratives, different characters, different themes, different facts. You turn on Fox News on any given day, and you're talking about almost a completely different news cycle than if you turn on MSNBC. I do think my experience is that, and I don't want to let the left off the hook here, because I think that to a certain extent they would like to flatter themselves that they do not live in an ideological bubble, but I think it's a little bit like fish don't know they're wet. It's because they're so surrounded by it that every reasonable person agrees with them. But I do get the sense that folks on the left still have a wider range of sources of information than those on the right. And by the way, I think that all of this is accelerating. I think that everything I describe in the book has gotten worse and will get worse in terms of the conservative media, seeing itself as not really being a transmitter of information as much as a soldier in the culture war.
I think one issue to be concerned about, and I should say I'm rarely shocked by anything, but one of the things that really shocked me was Jack Posobiec. Yeah. I'm not sure if I'm getting his name right, but he was the Pizzagate conspiracy guy, was awarded a fellowship by the Claremont Institute, and I was truly shocked by that. And if you have incentives for conspiracy theorists to spread conspiracies, that's a whole new universe.
No, I was also, I share the same thing as I'm increasingly hard to shock, but I'm still shocked. And I think that's good. I think it's important not to normalize all of this. But what you are describing was genuinely appalling, because you have somebody from the far reaches of the fever swamp. And to go back to your original question about the evolution of the conservative media, in my book, one of the things I'm really fascinated about was the way in which some of the more radioactive, some of the more toxic conspiracy theorists were brought into the mainstream by people like the Drudge Report. They actually became part of the conservative media infrastructure. And guys like Jack Posobiec, who's spreading these just bizarre and sick conspiracy theories that have been completely discredited, have developed audiences and have not paid this. That, look, in a rational universe, these folks would be absolutely exiled. Nobody would take them seriously. So the fact that he is part of the media infrastructure was pretty outrageous. But then when the Claremont Institute named him a fellow, this is one of those moments where you go, are there any guardrails at all? Are there any freaking standards at all? I mean, I understand that they have been moving to a more aggressive pro-Trumpian stand. But in what alternative reality do you take someone who has been that discredited and name him a fellow? So that not only are there now, active incentives in the conservative media to be the most outrageous, to be the most extreme, to throw out the most bizarre theories, but there are no stigmas. There's no price to be paid, or the price to be paid is not obvious. Now, having said that, there are people who have fallen off. I mean, there are the Milo Yiannopoulos who were big stars for a while, but Milo Yiannopoulos, who traffics in some of just the most vile rhetoric, really only was exiled when, because he was appearing to endorse pedophilia. Everything else apparently was okay. But yeah, the Posobiec incident was, there's so many troubling markers, but that was a big one.
Now, do you still keep in touch with other conservative radio hosts and see any changes in that landscape occurring?
I do keep in touch. I do keep in touch with some, many of whom have lost their jobs, either because they've quit or because they've been fired or because they're just, fed up with it. But what I find interesting is just watching the way in which conservatism has changed. For example, in Wisconsin, I tell this story. In Wisconsin, all the conservative talk show hosts were anti-Trump. He did not have the luxury that he had elsewhere. He did not have air cover from conservative talk radio, and he lost badly. In Wisconsin, Ted Cruz, who, by the way, is not a good fit for Wisconsin, beat him handily because all the talk show hosts thought that Donald Trump was such an aberration. But every one of those hosts, I'm off the air, host in Green Bay is off the air, every one of those other hosts now is completely pro-Trump. And in part, that reflects the way in which the audience has come to see conservative media as a safe space. Despite all the conservative critiques of universities being safe space, on the right, they demand the conservative media be a safe space that confirms their bias, that gives them, reassures them about their views, and they're very intolerant for dissenting points of view. So as a result, conservative talk shows comes on and expresses outrage about President Trump's comments about the loyalty of Jews, or mocks him for canceling his trip to Denmark because they won't negotiate the sale of Greenland. They're going to get a huge amount of backlash, and you would get 80-90% of the callers calling in saying, why are you saying this? Why are you not backing our president? So that's part of the morphing, is there was a time when in conservative media you had a variety of ideas. You could have really lively discussions, and you could criticize the sitting president of the United States. People like that, but support and loyalty to Trump is now a requirement.
You talked about one revision you made in the paperback edition regarding Gingrich, and one thing you got wrong. Have you received any other interesting critiques of the book that have made you rethink some of the points you've made?
Oh yeah, many. And part of this is my argument, and which I'm still reasonably comfortable with, although I question it all the time, that many of the crackpot elements of the right, or the overt hyper nationalist nativist streams of conservative thought, these were always there, but they were recessive genes. And that there was still a dominant, relatively healthy mainstream. I've had interesting debates about that with a number of people, including, you know, going back and forth with Max Boot, who has come to a different conclusion. He believes that these things were much more virulent and run deeper. And of course, you know, when, you know, I go back and I will, you know, talk about, you know, the role of William F. Buckley Jr. and National Review in creating a healthy conservative movement, and people go back and point out the editorials that were written about race and segregation in the 1950s, and I will admit, I cringe when I read them, because this is going back to the founding, you know, the present at the creation. Was some stuff that was pretty ugly that conservatives, you know, had not come to grips with. And also, I guess, you know, part of it is that, you know, because of where I'm from, Wisconsin, and the people that I associated with, I think the whole, you know, emphasis on fiscal conservatism, which now turns out to be kind of a joke, you have to go back and go, was any of that real? And I would like to think that it was real. I believed it was real, but clearly it was paper thin in the conservative movement.
And I don't know if you're familiar with Corey Robbins' work, but his idea, which has been, it would change my perspective, because I used to draw my perspectives just from social psychology. His perspective is that conservatives tend to not be focused so much on tradition, but rather on preserving the status of people who were at the top of a hierarchy. So it does seem like even going forward, we might see one strain of conservative politics being people defending some shade of white supremacy, perhaps, or the right of people who are billionaires like the Koch brothers to influence the political system with no guardrails. Do you see that as a liability?
Well, there are many liabilities. I'm not familiar with his work, so, you know, keep that in mind as I say this. My experience with conservatism was really not consistent with that. And I think also as you watch what's happening now to the right wing, you know, there is this a genuine populist element to all of this. You know, that there are people who was not about wealth. It was not about, I mean, you know, see, this is part of the problem, is like what was real and what wasn't real. The Tea Party movement, for example, I believe was a sincere reaction, at least in the beginning, to what they saw as government overreach. It was a sincere grassroots effort, but it was taken over by people who had different agendas. So you have this disconnect between grassroots conservatives who are, in fact, concerned about traditional values, who are concerned about things like, you know, just living a decent good life, versus people who say, okay, we're going to get you to vote for us, and then we're going to become tools of corporate America, and we're going to be tools of K Street. So that's part of the dilemma. You know, what was real and what was not real.
Right. In your book, you do talk about, in the early part of the book, you talk about what changed your perspective and your father's perspective, which was returning Vietnam War veterans being insulted and demeaned by very left-wing hippies, so to speak. Do you feel like that was a foundational experience for people of your generation?
Well, yes, for many of and many of the people that I have associated with over the years, you know, many of the people, and I know it's become a dirty word to say things like, you know, neoconservative, but a group of conservatives who had been liberals in the 1950s and 1960s, who became disillusioned with liberalism and went over to conservatism, who were really driven away. And I think that in the division in the Republican Party over Donald Trump, you still see some of the signs of that, that folks who came from a liberal tradition, and by the way, I mean both big L and small L tradition, were those who were the least likely to go along with Donald Trump. It was certainly a foundational, you know, experience for me. You know, I grew up in a very, very liberal household. My father was the president of the Wisconsin Civil Liberties Union. He was the campaign manager for Eugene McCarthy back in 1968 when he was the anti-war candidate running against Lyndon Johnson. When I was in eighth grade, I flew around the state in the campaign plane with Eugene McCarthy. I was at the 1968 Democratic National Convention. I was a page there. I was on the executive board of the Young Democrats of Wisconsin for several years. And yet, like many other people who became, you know, active in the conservative movement, I think it was the excesses, it was the It was the intellectual exhaustion of the left in the late 1970s that drove people away.
So before we wrap up, it's almost time to wrap up. What future projects have you got? Do you have another book in the works?
Well, you know what? At this point, I think it's time to sit back and wait and to see how this all plays out, because my crystal ball is extremely cloudy right now. So what I'm devoting myself to is working with the Bulwark. I do a daily podcast. I put out a newsletter trying to track what's happening. But I think for a book, I'm going to need to sit back and have a larger perspective, because when I wrote this book, How the Right Lost Its Mind, part of it was just for myself. Like, what the hell just happened? What did I not get? How did this takeover of the Republican Party and this transformation of this Republican Party occur? And I'm not sure that I got it completely right. So there's going to be a perspective when we see what the world looks like post-Trump, how much of it is enduring, how much of it is just a blip, whether we're ever going to come back from this precipice. I just don't know. So I'm probably going to wait until then.
All right. Well, I really enjoy the Bulwark podcast. I guess my only complaint is that I sometimes have to delete other podcasts so I have time to listen to the Bulwark.
Sorry about that.
That to flatter you. That's actually something that's going on. Well, thank you for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Hey, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks for tuning in. As always, if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review on iTunes. It helps other people find out about the show. And you can reach me at podcast@heterodoxacademy.org and on Twitter at ChrisMartin76.
This podcast is produced by Heterodox Academy. Find us online at heterodoxacademy.org, on Twitter at HDX Academy, and on Facebook.